Some veteran China hands attributed the lack of public enthusiasm to the fact that America and the People's Republic of China had no official diplomatic relations. But I think Bill Buckley got it right. During a roundtable interview I did later with a few of the print journalists, Buckley said he didn't think the Chinese public knew who Nixon was. After all, he pointed out, they still didn't know that we, or anyone, had landed on the moon a few years before. That's how controlled the news was there. My job in China was to cover the daytime activities of the Nixons, report on any stories I gathered myself, and to describe, live by satellite, the major evening activities, which I could not actually attend. Our cameras were in the Great Hall, but I was almost an hour away at the broadcast center watching the banquets on a TV monitor. On the menu tonight are spongy bamboo shoots, shark spin in three shreds, fried and stewed prawns, I would report to the Today Show audience. Hear the music? Sound familiar? The large Chinese orchestra is playing Home on the Range. I ad-libbed much of what I said, just as I had ad-libbed in Persepolis, but this time I didn't have a friendly colleague talking into my ear on a headphone. When I finished my banquet reporting for television, I was rushed by our radio producer to another makeshift studio to describe to listeners what had just been shown on television. One night, about midnight, on my way home from the radio broadcast, I talked with Mr. Ching, one of the interpreters. "How old are your children?" I asked. "I have three, 11, 7, and 3 years old," he replied, "but I have not seen my three-year-old since he was born." Turned out the interpreter had been an office worker, as had his wife. During this decade of the Cultural Revolution, in which millions of Chinese teachers, educated office workers, and intellectuals were forced to live as peasants so as to toe the party line, Mr. Ching had been sent to an adult reform school and then to work in the fields. His wife was still working at a different farm. He had no idea when he would see her again. His children were living with their grandmother. He didn't know when his wife would be back to care for them. We heard similar stories throughout our trip, especially when we visited Peking University, which had been newly reopened after being forced to close during the early years of the Cultural Revolution. It had been one of the finest universities in Asia until it was shut down and its students disbanded. Some of the most prominent professors had been paraded down the street wearing dunce caps and jeered at by teenage members of the Red Guard. Like Mr. Ching, most of the teachers had been sent away to reform centers and were then imprisoned or sent to work in the fields. They were just now returning. With this kind of attitude against almost anyone who was educated, it is all the more astonishing to realize what the Chinese have accomplished in the 30-odd years since the demise of the hated Cultural Revolution. President Nixon's attempt to bridge the philosophical gap between our two countries was challenging, to say the least, but he was certainly trying. During the days, he and his entourage, for the most part, met privately with their Chinese counterparts. We followed Pat Nixon as she visited schools, daycare centers, factories, and communes, all carefully selected by her hosts. Mrs. Nixon, who seemed shy and remote to most Americans, blossomed in China. She was having a wonderful time, gracious and smiling and particularly good with the children. The Chinese opened up to her as much as they could open up to anyone at that time. How sad that her life in the White House would end in grief and isolation 2 years later, when her husband was forced to resign his office over the Watergate scandal. I was reminded of the book Johnny, We Hardly Knew Ye, written after President Kennedy's assassination. There could easily have been another book called Pat Nixon, We Hardly Knew You. Traipsing around after the First Lady, however, had more than its share of challenges for me. I was carrying my own camera and a tape recorder. They looked very much alike, and as I am the least handy person you could find, I often took out my camera when I wanted the tape recorder, or the tape recorder when I wanted the camera. Even worse, at one point I found myself almost alone with Mrs. Nixon, and, hoping to get a brief, exclusive interview with her, I beckoned over the only camera crew I could see and asked if they would film it. They looked kind of startled, but did the filming. Only later did I learn that they were a CBS crew, not NBC. CBS was furious that I got this scoop and at first wouldn't release the film. NBC then became furious with CBS for not releasing the film, and it almost became an international incident until I apologized profusely and everyone cooled down. But that gaffe did not go over well with my fellow journalists in China. Instead of thinking of me as a klutz, which I was, they thought I was being a prima donna. It did not add to my popularity. When I wasn't following Mrs. Nixon or going out to find my own stories, always accompanied by Miss Tang, I repaired to the neat, sparse room I shared with Faye Wells at the hotel. There, waiting for me, was a most comfortable bed with a big, puffy quilt. Also waiting, a comb, brush, toothpaste, shaving cream, pencils, pens, postcards with scenes from Chinese ballets, hard candies, hot water for tea, which I could also use to sterilize my contact lenses, and always tangerines. Thank God for the tangerines. On busy days, I lived on them. Herb Kaplow, one of my fellow NBC correspondents, joked that on his first day back home, he woke up, reached for a tangerine, and ate his light bulb. We also had big, roomy bathtubs, no showers, and unexpected luxuries. One-day laundry service and one-hour pressing, a godsend since we were allowed to bring only one small suitcase, and floor men on each floor to wait on us and bring us food at any hour. Breakfast was the highlight. We could choose Western or Chinese. I chose Chinese, which included delicious chicken noodle soup, a selection of cold meats, vegetables, spring rolls, and one lucky morning, spare ribs with sweet and sour sauce. Who needed oatmeal anyway? We certainly didn't need a wastebasket. One of the most maddening Chinese habits to deal with made us unable to throw anything out. Whatever we tried to dispose of, a torn pair of stockings, a used Kleenex, an empty bottle of shampoo, was neatly wrapped up and returned to us. Stories did not come so neatly wrapped. Though we were supposedly free to go wherever we wanted, there was no way to get there. There were no taxis, no private cars, no transportation whatsoever, except for the official buses and cars which moved us from place to place. I had seen a department store within walking distance of the hotel, so I asked Miss Tang to take me and my cameraman to film what turned out to be called the #1 department store. Stores had no names, they were numbered as they were built. My theory has always been, show me a department store, and I'll show you how people live. The Macy's of China was large, crowded, and cold, heated by one coal stove near the entrance. Bicycles, the most prized possession, no one owned a car, cost about $60. The average factory worker made about $20 a month. Denying himself all the extras, a worker could probably buy a bicycle at the end of the year, or maybe a sewing machine, the next most cherished item, which also cost about $60. Shoes cost $1.50 a pair, and face cream and shampoo were sold by the glob. I did a show-and-tell report on the store for broadcast later that evening. Next door to the store was a pharmacy, the #1 pharmacy, that sold the prize souvenirs for foreigners, plastic acupuncture dolls. They were small, white, slimy-feeling dolls with innumerable markings for insertion of the needles. The needles themselves were from 3 to 8 inches long, a sort of do-it-yourself acupuncture kit. The pharmacy also had white, slimy acupuncture ears. Chinese doctors thought that the ears contain most of the nerve endings of the body. The dolls and the ears turned out to be the most popular souvenirs I brought home, along with the large red buttons bearing the face of Chairman Mao that virtually all the Chinese wore. Dr. Paul Marks, my friend at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, went crazy over the ear I brought him. Acupuncture techniques had barely reached this country, and the Chinese were boasting that they did operations with no anesthesia, only needles. One afternoon before we left Peking, some of the reporters were treated to a view of an actual operation. The patient, I was told, was lying on an operating table had his eyes open and seemed totally relaxed. I, who can't bear a pinprick, avoided this excursion and settled for bringing home a half dozen plastic ears. What I didn't bring home, which was also for sale, and would you believe it, in that puritanical country where I was told no one married for love, but because they were politically compatible, was a selection of aphrodisiacs. I managed to get permission to film another story, this one at the Evergreen People's Commune. The agricultural commune was just 10 minutes from our hotel, where we enjoyed hot and cold running water and quite luxurious bathrooms. The commune had neither. We visited the home of a farming family named Kong. It made the spare little coal miners' houses I'd seen in Wales look like Trump Plaza. The Kong's two-room farmhouse had a mud floor, a brick and wood bed, heated from beneath by a box of hot coals, an outhouse, and nothing else. Yet the Kongs, too, towed the Communist Party line. Yes, they had enough food to eat, and heat in the winter, and clean, warm clothing, all of which they owed to Chairman Mao, who had taken the farm away from a brutal landlord and given it to the peasants. It was a good piece, I thought, because it was the only time we were invited into a real Chinese home and could show viewers at home not only how the Chinese lived, but how they thought. I sent it off to New York, but somewhere between the Evergreen People's Commune and Rockefeller Center, it disappeared. For all I know, it may still be en route. The long days, often stretching from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m., began to get to me as the week progressed. I realized then, as I do now writing this, that I was depressed. And this is the sour part. All was not well between me and some of my male colleagues. The enmity had begun before we even got to China, when we made an overnight stop in Hawaii. Henry Kissinger and a few others from the White House staff, including Nixon Secretary Rosemary Woods and speechwriter Pat Buchanan, were invited by Claire Booth Luce, who was living in Honolulu, to a small dinner. Mrs. Luce was the wife of the founder of Time Incorporated, a formidable presence herself. Dr. Kissinger and I had become off-camera friends, following my far-ranging interview with him for Today, and he asked Mrs. Luce if I could be invited to the dinner too. That's what started the sour part. I wasn't the only reporter invited. John Chancellor was there, as was Theodore White. But being the only woman journalist made me stand out. The reporters who were not invited, and most were not, resented my access to Kissinger and White House staff. In their eyes, I was the upstart, unseasoned and spoiled. It didn't help when Kissinger drew me aside for a private chat. The consensus was that he was giving me some sort of advance scoop, when in fact, he was merely asking me if I had the time and opportunity in China to buy some souvenirs for him to take home to his family and friends. But not for Nancy McGuinness, the woman he was seeing who would become his wife. At the time, Nancy, who was quite conservative, wanted nothing to do with the Chinese communists and had told Henry she wanted no presence from that country. She has since become very fond of China and many of its leaders. This shopping aside with Kissinger just added fuel to the fire. The print journalists were already deeply resentful of the large contingent from television in the China press corps. While the White House had limited the print media to one writer per newspaper or magazine and to a pool of photographers, they had permitted the networks to send large crews of TV technicians and cameramen. The Nixon White House cleverly anticipated the public relations value of images of the president in exotic forbidden China being beamed live by satellite into America's living rooms, and they were bending over backward to accommodate the television contingent. The television staffers were often provided cars to ferry them around, for example, while disgruntled print journalists had to ride on buses. The resentment of the newspaper and magazine reporters was well-founded. It was Richard Nixon's television show from beginning to end. He didn't trust the Washington press corps, who he felt were liberals and responsible for the public outcry against the war in Vietnam. Nixon wanted to bypass the press and go directly to the American people, and live television was the perfect vehicle. Unfortunately, I got caught in the crossfire. The print journalists couldn't really take out their anger on seasoned television journalists like the beloved Walter Cronkite or the universally respected John Chancellor. So whom did they single out? Yep, me. A few photographers went so far as to circulate a story that they had dumped a whole pile of ruined film on the floor outside my hotel room. If they did, I never saw it. They claimed that I had stuck so close to Mrs. Nixon that I was in every one of their images of her. I doubt it. I was usually no closer to Mrs. Nixon than the male reporters. Another story that some photographers had dumped their smelly long johns in the wastebasket in my hotel room, knowing the hotel would return them to me, absolutely did not happen. Just an adolescent locker room fantasy. What did happen is that basically the print reporters shut me out. When they gathered together at the end of the day for a drink, I was not included. When they sat and chatted on one of the bus rides, I was not asked to join in the conversation. Even Max Frankel, the future executive editor of the New York Times, who would win a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the China trip, turned me away. One evening he was going out to eat with a few colleagues, and when I asked if I could join them, Max made up some lame excuse and off they went without me. Years later, Max apologized to me and told me how badly he still felt about it, but the truth is, they just didn't want me along. I was the upstart. I was the Today Show, which was getting attention and for which they had no respect. But I certainly didn't understand that then. What have I done to these guys, I kept thinking. What have I done to make them hate me? I thought of things like the dinner party in Hawaii and my private conversation with Kissinger, and while standing with the president, the smiles of recognition he would sometimes give me. I was beginning to look like the teacher's pet. And you know how people feel about the teacher's pet. Then there was Haldeman, who was running around China with his own movie camera. My interview with him had been just a few weeks before, and he kept smiling at me in China, and even winked at me on occasion. That might have set the other reporters' teeth on edge. They'd never so much as managed to interview Haldeman, and here I was on a winking basis with the president's chief of staff. Looking back on it now, I can better understand the hostility. Every other television correspondent had worked at some point in print. Though the print people considered them sellouts to the vulgar, higher-paying positions in television, they still shared common backgrounds. I didn't. I was a child of television. Plus, I was a woman, while they were all members of the old boys' club. But I didn't get it then. However, my colleagues from NBC, especially John Chancellor, were very friendly and supportive. That helped make up for the others. I was also fascinated by China during that epic week. It was my personal life that was unsettled and contributed a great deal to my sense of loneliness. Because of the satellite, it was easy to call home. But I didn't have anyone to call. I couldn't call Lee. After all, we had just separated. I couldn't call my parents either. They were already worried about me going to so distant a part of the world. A phone call would just lead to all kinds of anxious questions. I was also concerned about leaving my little girl. What if something happened to her, or she got sick, and I was on the other side of the world? I knew that Zell was fully capable of handling anything that could go wrong, so that was one call I could make. I telephoned home whenever I could, told Jackie I missed her and loved her dearly, and asked Zell to turn on the Today Show before Jackie went off to nursery school so she could see her mommy in that strange land called China. Then I hung up the phone, felt even lonelier, and went back to work. After another long day following Mrs. Nixon, I went to my broadcasting booth to report on the major cultural event of the visit, a special ballet to be performed at the Great Hall of the People. All the Westerners, reporters, technicians, everybody, had been invited to see what was billed as the Red Detachment of Women. The theme of the Red Detachment had to do mostly with female soldiers kicking the hell out of anyone who opposed the communist regime. Hardly Swan Lake. But the big news was offstage, because the invitations to the event had been extended by the most important woman in China, the wife of Mao Zedong, who was known by her maiden name, Shang Qing. She herself was attending the performance. Madame Shang was what we would call a piece of work. Everyone was dying to meet her. She was Mao's fourth wife, a generation younger than he, a former actress, beautiful, and many thought, evil. Mao had divorced his third wife to marry her. No one knew if they had children. Probably didn't dare ask. Anyway, up until the 1960s, little was heard from Miss Chang. Then, during the Cultural Revolution, she rose like the Dragon Lady to form the infamous Gang of Four, which brutally purged intellectuals, writers, and revisionist government officials. She had many of them put to death. She also took it upon herself to revise China's repertoire of ballets and operas, banning anything that had to do with China's rich cultural past, and replacing them with eight revolutionary Maoist works. This ballet was one of them. Her brutal dictatorial ways would catch up with her. When her husband died 4 years later, she was tried, sentenced first to death, then to life in prison, and is said to have committed suicide in 1991. But on the night of the ballet, sitting with her husband between the Nixons, she was an imposing and fascinating figure. In my little booth, miles away from the ballet, I could only describe her for the Today Show audience from my television monitor. We never met. After the ballet was over, at about 11 p.m., we were told that a bus would take us to the Friendship Shop, as the store for foreigners in every major Chinese city was called. It was open 24 hours a day, and you could buy a jade ring for $4,000 or an emerald necklace for $20,000. It was there that I bought the presents for Henry Kissinger and some beautiful silk brocade for myself. I still wear the skirt I had made from the brocade. At the shop, I became a bit more popular with the other members of the press. Several of them asked my advice about presents to bring back home for their wives or kids. The ice was melting. Back to bed by 1 a.m., up again for the Chinese chicken noodle soup at 6 a.m. The week went by in a blur. Visits to more factories, schools with tiny tots dressed alike in their uniforms, singing the praises of Chairman Mao. Mrs. Nixon told me she thought the children were receiving a surprisingly well-rounded education. She said that in the second grade they were doing math she couldn't do. I wish I could stay longer, she mused. But my anxiety level remained high. I had no idea how my live reporting was coming across in New York and whether they were even running the filmed stories I sent back. I felt extremely inadequate, especially when I was broadcasting from the Jerry-built communications center. The walls were paper thin. I could hear Walter Cronkite broadcasting from one small studio, Harry Reasoner in the next studio, and John Chancellor across the hall. How could I possibly compete with those titans? Ironically, it was President Nixon who reassured me that I was doing a good job. We were all at the Great Wall of China, the zenith of Nixon's television week, with cameras positioned to beam his every step back to America as he strolled casually along with the Chinese premier, Zhou Enlai. When the stroll ended and the cameras were turned off, he came over to compliment me on a report I'd done on a gymnastics event the night before. "How do you know about it?" I asked the president. "Oh, I get word by telephone every morning," he said. So the canny television-savvy president was keeping track of the ratings during his trip to China. That said a lot about him, but regardless, it was music to my ears. Yet it almost left me stranded at the Great Wall. The chat with the president left me little time to find the NBC car I was assigned to. I wasn't going to make the same mistake I had made with the CBS crew, but then I wasn't about to spend the next 5 years trying to get back to the hotel from the Great Wall on my own. To my relief, I saw Av Weston getting into a car. I had worked with Av years before at CBS, and he was now the executive producer of ABC Nightly News. I asked if I could hitch a ride with him, and he said sure, and squeezed me in next to the chief ABC correspondent, Harry Reasoner, who could not have been more jolly. I would remember this happy ride years later when I went to ABC and thought I must have dreamt it, but I'm getting ahead of myself. That night, our last in Peking, the Chinese press, all 26 of them, invited the American press to dinner. I joined the group when I got off the air. Conversation at the table, me to a very bright Chinese journalist on my left. "We've asked you so many questions. Anything you are curious about concerning America or Americans?" "No." "Anything you desire, like a car or another bicycle?" "No, I have all I want." "You have two sons. What do you hope for them?" "That they do not have bad habits and grow up to serve the people." I mention all this because so many of us have now visited China or read about it, and once more, it is almost impossible to see how that closed, regimented society blossomed into the modern society, albeit communist, it is today. On the sixth day of the trip, we flew to beautiful Hangzhou, known as the Venice of China. In the bad old days, the city was the home of rich, beautiful women, of beautiful silk, and of the best tea in China. It was like a picture book with its lakes, pagodas, and temples. President and Mrs. Nixon took a boat ride on West Lake, and so did we. The president was in great humor. It was lovely and relaxing, and as it was the weekend, I didn't have to work that night. I also attended my first banquet. Since I had been living on the ubiquitous tangerines and breakfast soup, everything tasted so delicious to me that I wrote down every single item we were served. There were small plates of roast chicken, fish in sweet and sour sauce, shrimp with green tea leaves, fried duck in spices, fried chicken squares with onions and peanuts, bamboo shoots stewed in peanut oil, bean soup with scallops, chrysanthemum cakes, egg rolls with sugar and sesame fillings, lotus seeds in rock sugar, and fruit. Divine. After the banquet, another first. The president walked slowly through the room, greeting us, and finally introducing us to the legendary Zhou Enlai, a slim, elegant gentleman who spoke some English. "This is Helen Thomas," the president said, introducing the veteran UPI reporter. "She's been reporting on the White House for 60 years. The remarkable Helen retired in 2000, just shy of her 80th birthday. And then the president introduced me to the premier. "This is Barbara Walters," he said to him. "We're just breaking her in." At our last stop, Shanghai, President Nixon signed a joint communique with his hosts, dealing with delicate future relations with Taiwan, and a joint pledge for a gradual increase in American-Chinese contacts and exchange. At the end of the communique, Nixon announced, "This was the week that changed the world." It changed the world of news as well. The China trip probably marked the seminal moment in which television assumed superiority as America's primary source of news. The print reporters were furious. Life magazine's Hugh Seidy complained that the White House seemed to treat writers as an unnecessary evil. When we got back, an editorial in the New York Times claimed that television had taken control of news coverage. The week in China also changed me. I learned more about reporting than at any time before or since, and I saw a country, before almost any other Westerners, emerge from the shadows into a new era. I would return to China several times over the years, including a trip with President Gerald Ford in 1975. But nothing would ever come close to that first visit in 1972. I felt humbled and grateful. What an extraordinary job I had. I was so fortunate. On my last afternoon in that atheist country, I said a little prayer of thanks. Our final night in China, I was again sharing a room with Faye. We were still up at 2 a.m, throwing away our old notes and trying to figure out a way to prevent the Chinese from returning our trash when there was a knock on the door. Two grave-looking Chinese men entered and dumped large gift-wrapped boxes into our laps. They weighed about 30 pounds each. "Candy, compliments of the Shanghai Municipal Revolutionary Government. said the one who could speak English. Faye and I burst out laughing. 2 in the morning and 30 pounds of candy to take home. We couldn't leave it there. The Chinese would never have forgiven us or allowed it. The next day, our American press planes picked us up, and lunch was hot dogs and hamburgers. Heavenly, not a tangerine in sight. The visit was over. I had survived and evidently done well. The word had come through from NBC that my reports from China had been given more airtime than any of our news team. Better yet, the NBC team had beaten the ratings of all the competition. I had even made a friend or two, not among the Chinese, but among my colleagues, especially John Chancellor, who had changed his mind about me during the course of the week, recognizing the hard work I'd done. He braved the disdain of the male chauvinists on the plane by stopping by my seat and planting a very public kiss on my cheek. Now it was time to go home and face a different challenge. Life without Lee. A Dead Marriage and the Dead Sea. I came back from China totally spent, but with the knowledge that I had done a better job than NBC or I ever expected. Still, when I opened the door to my apartment, there was no one there to hug me and say, "Welcome home, I'm proud of you." Lee was gone. I had wanted to be free for a long while, and now I was. But freedom has consequences. The same person whom you have yearned to leave, or to leave you, is also the person you miss when you want someone to care and to fuss over you. Things would have been easier had Lee and I argued or called each other names, but it was never like that. Lee had been there when my on-air career began. I had been there for his Broadway ventures. We had the joy of adopting our baby and watching her grow. Lee was a good father. I, in turn, was a good stepmother to his children, and I wanted to keep that relationship going. I felt sad for Lee and for myself. I also decided that 2 marriages were enough, and I vowed never to marry again. I didn't keep the vow. This was an easier decision for me to make than it would have been for many women. I had enough money to continue living in the same style as during my marriage, and I wasn't afraid of being alone. If anything, with a very busy career and a young child, I never seemed to have as much time by myself as I wanted. Being alone seemed very desirable. Lee and I had no financial disputes. There was no alimony and no settlement on either side. Lee gave me minimal child support for Jackie. He wanted to. She was, he felt, his responsibility too. It all seemed fair. Lee could see Jackie whenever he wanted. We never had a formal agreement about that, and it never caused a problem. Our apartment was a rental, I kept it, and Lee rented a smaller apartment for himself. Aside from the fact that we were tearing a marriage apart, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? Things were pretty tidy. My parents, however, were very upset. My father had become especially close to Lee and kept asking me, "Why? Why?" Every answer sounded weak. They felt terrible for Lee, but they were also anxious about me, as was Shirley. Shirley, my confidant, my best friend, had always supported my decisions before, and I was sure she would now. But she didn't. It wasn't that she didn't understand how I felt. I had often confided in her my vague discontent, which became stronger and less vague as the months and years went on. But like my parents, she was worried about my future. "Lee will be fine," she said. "He'll have no trouble finding someone else. But you're pushing 40. You don't leave one man until you have another." She worried about Jackie's future. Who would pay the doctor's bills, the school tuitions, college? "Who knows how secure your job is?" She pointed a finger at me. "Right now you're doing great, but anything can happen in your business. You lost a job in television before, it could happen again." I listened, but I didn't change my mind. I would take my chances. One amusing rumor, at least amusing to me, that started circulating was that I'd left Lee for Henry Kissinger. Kissinger never entered my mind when Lee and I separated. I admired him and enjoyed his company, but there was never a romance. I had also been introduced to his future wife, Nancy McGinnis, whom I liked immediately. They would marry in 1974. But to some of the Washington and New York columnists, for Kissinger and me to be an item made great sense. Certainly, Shirley thought so. "Henry Kissinger would be perfect for you," Shirley said. "He's nice, he's smart, and he's Jewish." In those first few weeks after I returned from China, I was not thinking at all of romance. I was much more concerned about my little girl. At first, she didn't fully realize that her father was no longer living at home. After all, he'd often been away at his different theaters. But soon enough, though she was only four, the separation began to have its effect. Lee couldn't have been more devoted to Jackie. He saw her often, never missed a school play, and took her away on vacations. He and I spoke to each other many times a week and never said a bad word about each other. But Jackie often protested and began to cry when Lee came to pick her up. I'm not sure she ever really forgave her father for moving out, although I always told her it was both our decision. As for Lee and me, after the first few months of pain, we began, little by little, to find our way back, and a real friendship developed, in part because of our love for our little girl. Lee eventually married a very smart and nice woman named Lois Wise. Lois was the co-founder and president of Wise Advertising and the author of more than 60 books, including the bestseller, Funny, You Don't Look Like a Grandmother. I knew Lois slightly. One of the commercials I did for the Today Show contained a famous slogan she had written for a jam and jelly company. With a name like Smucker's, it has to be good. Lois sometimes came to the set to check that we were doing right by her client. I liked her then, and later, after she and Lee married, we became friends. Lois adored Lee, seemed to love his show business life, and accepted the fact that he and I had an unusual feeling of warmth for each other. I remember being at a party with the two of them one freezing winter night. The party was around the corner from my apartment, but when it was time to go home, I was nervous about attacking the icy streets in the dark alone. It was Lois who urged Lee to walk me back to my building. He and I walked arm in arm, as old friends do. Lee continued to follow the siren song of Broadway. The last and very expensive musical he would produce in 1986, Rags, closed after only four performances. This time, more than his heart was broken. 6 months later, he was diagnosed with inoperable brain cancer. Lois nursed him devotedly and without complaint through a long siege of chemotherapy. As the disease progressed, I visited often. Lois always welcomed me. In the last months of his life, when I am not sure Lee really knew who I was, my visits still seemed to give him some pleasure. Lee died in March 1988 at the age of 67. The morning of his death, Lois telephoned me. "Can you come?" she asked. I ran right over, and we sat alone and held hands. I realize it may sound strange, but Lois somehow knew, without jealousy, that I meant a great deal to the man she loved and that he continued to mean a great deal to me. For years, until her own death in 2007, we called each other with a smile, sisters-in-law. But 15 years earlier, although there was nothing as profound in my life as my separation from Lee, there were also separations in my professional life that were making me sad. In January 1973, my on-camera buddy and off-camera support, Joe Garagiola, left the Today Show. The given reason, which so many people still use to shade the truth, was that he wanted to spend more time with his family. The real reason, I believe, was Frank McGee. Frank never really understood Joe's value to the program. To him, Joe was an over-the-hill baseball player and something of a joke. Joe was hardly that. He was very smart and, moreover, very wise. The tension on the set had eroded the spirit of friendship and goodwill that Joe, Hugh, and I had felt toward one another. We had traveled together, had uncountable meals together. We knew each other's families and celebrated each other's birthdays. Happy, happy years. But with Frank's arrival, all that had changed. In contrast, Frank and I never had breakfast or lunch together, and I don't remember ever having a personal conversation with him. I'd sent him a Christmas card or a present on his birthday, but I never received an acknowledgement, let alone a thank you. During this hostile period, I had felt closer than ever to Joe. We could count on each other for a laugh or help in a tight spot. After all, Joe and I had spent 5 great years together, longer than some marriages, so his departure caused me real pain. It was even tougher to keep that happy face on camera for 2 hours every morning. Enter Gene Shalit, the wild-haired, handlebar-mustached, bow-tied arts critic from Look magazine. I adored him from the beginning, though at first the Today audience did not. Gene was far more sophisticated and subtle than the down-to-earth Garagiola. And he sure looked different. Joe didn't have much hair, while Gene had more than enough for both of them. But Gene's witty and often biting theater and movie reviews soon won over the viewers. He became one of the most influential motion picture critics in the country, and we became lifelong friends. Working with Frank McGee meant having to continue to go outside of the studio to do my own interviews. In August 1973, I went way outside the New York studio. The occasion was the 25th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. I had an interview lined up there with Prime Minister Golda Meir. This was my first trip of what would be many to the Middle East. Curiously, although I'm Jewish, I had never had any great desire to go to Israel. I'd never felt any special religious or spiritual connection to the Jewish state, perhaps because my parents and I were not religious and none of our relatives lived there. The closest my father had come to identifying with the tiny country's beleaguered population was by buying those Israel bonds. So I had little sense of expectation when I arrived in Jerusalem. To my great surprise, Israel overwhelmed me and aroused feelings I never knew I had. No visitor, Jewish or not, can fail to be moved by the stunning history in the ancient walled city of Jerusalem. I couldn't get over the beauty of the land itself, at once rocky and arid, yet lush where the Israelis had ingeniously brought water to the desert. I felt a startling and quite strong connection. I understood the pride and suffering and the stubbornness that drives Israelis. While I was there, I wanted to interview Moshe Dayan, the Israeli defense minister. A former military commander and chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, Dayan was a dashing and heroic figure in the United States. He was very good-looking, with a strong face and high cheekbones and an eye patch to cover the eye he had lost to a sniper in Syria. Even though he had been raised as a farmer on an Israeli kibbutz, someone once described him, I think accurately, as looking like an Oriental prince. That's the dashing part. The heroics were his military past and his civilian role as defense minister during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, which the Israelis won hands down. The problem, Israeli officials told me, was that no one was authorized to arrange interviews for Dayan. He alone decided to whom he was going to talk, and he usually said no. I put in my request for an interview and prepared to wait. It was one of the best waits I've ever had. In the era before cell phones, waiting to hear from a potential interviewee often required sitting alone in a hotel room all day next to the phone. But not in Israel. The government and the NBC bureau in Tel Aviv knew where I was every second, so I took some time to explore Jerusalem. I roamed the ancient city, home to the 3 major religions of the world, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish. I traced the steps of Jesus. I poked my nose into the various nooks and corners of the old city, where everything from spices to watches was sold. The city, still the ultimate source of conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, is one of the most fascinating places in the world. One memorable night, I was planning to go hear the Israel Philharmonic, but got sidetracked by a very attractive Israeli professor I'd met that afternoon on a tour of Old Jerusalem. "Don't go to the concert," he said. "Let me show you the Dead Sea by moonlight." The Dead Sea by moonlight. How could one resist? Off we drove that evening to the lowest point on earth, just an hour from Jerusalem. The moon was just coming up, illuminating this still calm water. I must have brought a bathing suit because I clearly remember going into the very salty, very warm water, which was so dense you could float effortlessly. In fact, that's all you could do. The mineral-rich water is too heavy to swim in. I calmly floated on my back in the moonlight, thinking how ironic it was to find such peace in such a volatile region. I could see the lights of the Kingdom of Jordan on the other side of the Dead Sea. It was so very close, yet it would be another 20 years before Jordan and Israel made peace. As I still hadn't heard anything from Moshe Dayan, I gave myself another treat, a few days at Sharm el-Sheikh, then an Israeli resort on the Red Sea. Since returned to Egyptian control, Sharm el-Sheikh would become first a popular resort and later the target of vicious terrorist attacks at the beginning of the 21st century. But in the summer of 1973, it was lovely and quiet. Then the message came in. Dayan had agreed to the interview. I had no idea what to expect. I heard from our NBC bureau that he hated to do interviews and could be rude and abrupt. Great. And that's what we became. Great friends. In my living room now, displayed on my bookshelves, are various ancient stone artifacts Moshe Dayan gave me over the years. He was a passionate amateur archaeologist and spent much of his free time on digs in the Holy Land. I, too, collect ancient artifacts, so Dayan and I had a bond. All the pieces he gave me, one of which he was using at the time as an ashtray, are signed by him and are among my most treasured possessions. To Barbara, with all best wishes, Judea, B.C. 4000, M. Dayan, is the handwritten inscription on the bottom of the ashtray. Our first encounter, in the backyard of his small two-bedroom house on the outskirts of Tel Aviv, was not particularly friendly. He had really been forced into the interview by the rising international outcry over Israel's seizure of a Lebanese passenger plane. The Israelis had been tipped off erroneously, it turned out, that a wanted Palestinian terrorist was on board. Dayan saw no need to apologize. "We are not terrorists. We catch terrorists. When the terrorists stop, we'll stop." All those years ago, and Dayan's words are still repeated in Israel today. Of the innumerable people I've interviewed, Dayan was certainly one of the bluntest. His best and occasionally worst quality was that he didn't care what anyone thought about him. I remember asking him something or other during the interview, to which he responded, "That's a silly question." "Okay," I charged back. "If you think that's a silly question, why don't you ask the right question, then answer it, and I'll just sit here and we'll be fine." He didn't expect that response from me. He laughed out loud. And that was the moment our friendship started. I also met his lovely second wife, Raquel, and we, too, became very fond of each other. My interviews with Meir and Dayan garnered a lot of attention. Even Frank McGee gave me a grudging, "Nice work," which was a big deal coming from him. There was so much interest in Israel then, as now, and its ongoing struggle to survive. Less than 2 months after my visit, the country was at war again. The October War, as the Egyptians called it, or the Yom Kippur War, as the Israelis called it, saw Israel in great danger after a surprise joint attack by Syria and Egypt. I followed the 1973 war closely and was relieved when Israel recovered from the initial attack and repelled its Arab enemies. But Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan were held accountable for the loss of Israeli lives and severely criticized for not having anticipated the attack. Both of these giants in Israeli government resigned. Mrs. Meir remained active politically, but would not hold another government post. Dayan would return to the Israeli cabinet in 1977 as foreign minister under Prime Minister Menachem Begin. On the domestic early morning television front, I was having my own little battle. Hardly history-making, but a field day for the media. CBS decided it was going to revamp the CBS Morning News to challenge Today. There had never been any real competition for NBC in the morning. But this time, CBS decided to hire the young, good-looking, snappy feature writer at The Washington Post, my old friend from the Persepolis days, Sally Quinn. I liked Sally a lot and was sorry we were going to be competing, but the media was delighted and did its best to create a catfight between us. New York Magazine ran a cover story with Sally sitting, legs crossed, on a pile of suitcases and the cover line, "Good morning, I'm Sally Quinn. CBS brought me here to make trouble for Barbara Walters." At least the magazine printed the letter I'd written Sally when I'd heard of her new assignment. CBS could not have made a better choice. I mean this in all sincerity, and look forward to seeing you very often now that you'll be in New York. I won't be able to catch you on camera, but I hope we'll get together off camera. For God's sake, let's avoid all those people in and out of the media who may try to create a feud between us. We like each other too much. I signed it, "Much luck and affection." The truth was, however, that I was somewhat anxious because I knew what a good and witty reporter Sally was. I had enough trouble with McGee. I didn't look forward to the daily comparison with Sally. She had a lot of contacts in Washington and qualities I didn't have, the first three being blonde hair, blue eyes, and youth. But CBS made the same mistake with Sally that NBC had made with Maureen O'Sullivan. The network assumed that a person who was wonderful being interviewed would be just as wonderful being the interviewer. Sally's debut in August 1973, teamed with a pleasant veteran newsman named Hughes Rudd, was not a great success. It was not Sally's fault. Not only was she sick and feverish, she later said, but nobody at CBS ever gave her any directions. They just threw her on the air and expected her to soar. It was an all but impossible assignment. The CBS Morning News did not make a dent in the ratings of the Today Show, which by then was drawing close to 4 million viewers a day, a huge audience at the time. Instead of being anxious about competition from Sally, I began to feel sorry for her. About 3 months after she started on CBS, we were pitched against each other for our respective networks on one of the most colorful stories of the year. The occasion was Princess Anne's wedding to Mark Phillips in London's Westminster Abbey in November 1973. The lavish wedding of the only daughter of Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip was the forerunner to Princess Diana's wedding to Anne's brother, Prince Charles. There was the same pageantry, and royalty and political leaders attended from all over the world. The Today Show and the CBS Morning News both covered the wedding live, starting at 5 a.m., because of the five-hour time difference. It's not that I am a saint, but by then I was really feeling compassion for Sally. She was struggling in London, while I could still remember, from the time I covered the investiture of Prince Charles as Prince of Wales, much about the royal traditions. I knew who the major players were and who among the guests were the so-called lesser royals, the term used for those royal relatives who were further than 10th in line to the throne. I shared much of this information with Sally. A quick learner, she got through the wedding just fine. But Sally would last just another few months at CBS before leaving to return to the Washington Post. Not only did her career flourish there, she married the Post's famous executive editor, Ben Bradley. They are still happily together, and she and I are still great friends. When I got back from London, everyone on the program was buzzing about Frank McGee, who had seemingly taken leave of his senses. He had plunged into a flagrant love affair with a young black production assistant named Mamie and had left his wife to live with her. It was unbelievable. Frank had been married happily, or so we thought, for many years to his wife Sue. He never took a trip for Today without her. She used to travel with him during the times he worked day and night at the political conventions. It seemed the most secure of marriages. The only possible hint that it wasn't was when I heard that Frank and his wife used to drink something like a pitcher of martinis a night. Do you drink until you're practically blotto every night if you are really happy? Nevertheless, we who worked with Frank were mystified as to why Frank suddenly upped and left his wife for Mammy. Mammy, who had babysat for Frank and Sue's grandchildren. Mammy, whom we all knew as fun, giggly, inefficient, and not even particularly pretty. How the drama stayed in-house and did not end up in the columns is beyond reckoning. But it didn't. We all kept it a secret. Just try that today. In this day and age, it would be front-page fodder for the tabloids, all over the internet, and with 10-minute updates on cable news shows. But although it was a secret, we were noticing some changes in Frank. In the past, he would have his makeup applied and his silvery hair combed in the large dressing room with the rest of us. Now he insisted on having his own dressing room, even though the other room was small and cramped. There were rumors that his hair was falling out. His skin tone seemed paler. Although he never said a word, we began to wonder if he was ill. But when a man is ill, isn't that when he most wants to be with his long, faithful wife? Surely this was not the moment to run off with someone less than half his age. Or was it? It all seemed so crazy. But because Frank was more distant than ever, none of us were privy to his thoughts or feelings. In the midst of all this drama, my friend and agent, Lee Stevens, was negotiating my new 3-year contract with NBC. It was September 1973, and with Not for Women Only now being syndicated in some 80 cities, Lee felt he was dealing from a position of strength. It turned out he was. He got me a substantial raise, but was not interested just in getting more money for me. Lee put in the contract that if Frank were ever to leave the program, voluntarily or involuntarily, I was to have the title of co-host with whoever succeeded him. It wasn't surprising that no one at NBC questioned that clause. The brass doing the negotiations believed that Frank would be doing the program for years to come. Our ratings were solid, and he was only 51. Therefore, the chance that they might have to make me a permanent co-host must have seemed ridiculously slim, certainly not within the 3 years of the contract they were currently negotiating. So NBC included that clause. I signed off on the deal and continued to get my own interviews outside the studio. There were plenty of interviews to get. A scandal of historic proportions was engulfing the Nixon White House in 1973. Watergate was in full bloom, and all the players in the daily headlines were in Washington. So, for much of that tumultuous time, was I. Resignation in Washington, victory in New York. The place to be in the summer of 1973 was Washington. The place to stay was at the Watergate Hotel. The show to be on was the Today Show. The Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, otherwise known as the Senate Watergate Committee, was holding public hearings to investigate the mounting crisis for the Nixon administration and the president himself. One shoe was dropping after another. What had begun the year before as a curious burglary at the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate complex had escalated into sensational charges of political spying, sabotage, wiretapping, burglary, and conspiracy. By the spring of 1973, the scandal had reached the highest echelons of Nixon's inner circle. John Dean, the White House counsel, had been fired, and Nixon's top staffers, including his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, he who winked at me in China, had been forced to resign. And now, the Senate hearings. I was free to be in Washington much of the summer. My little girl was with Lee, who had taken a summer house in West Hampton, Long Island. My parents and my sister were in Miami, and I spoke to them 3 times a week. My mother told me some disturbing news about my father. He seemed to be losing strength, she said, and slept most of the day. I felt that it was depression, but I didn't know what I could do about it. I was broadcasting from the NBC studio in Washington, doing features and interviews, while Frank anchored the program from New York. Between us, we had all the major Watergate players on Today. Hardly a day passed when I didn't interview a congressman, a senator, a constitutional lawyer, a pollster, or somebody knowledgeable about the crisis. With so many Washington interviews to do, the McGee edict that I couldn't come in until the fourth question quietly went away. Frank did his interviews from New York, and I did mine by remote from the NBC studio in Washington, and it was quite a calm period between us. I'm sure he was happy that I'd been reassigned to Washington, somewhat like sending me to China. Many of the journalists in town for the hearings were staying at the Watergate Hotel, and we gathered in the evening to compare notes. The Old Boys Club finally had begun to accept me because I had good stories to swap from my morning interviews. The nightly news programs did not do interviews back then. The only other news program doing interviews, and taped at that, was 60 Minutes, but that CBS program was only on once a week. Today was on 5 mornings a week, live for 2 hours. It was a huge advantage. For all of us in news, whether television or print, covering Watergate was one of the most interesting and exciting experiences you could have. The stars were the young Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who kept breaking one Watergate story after another. But there was more than enough material for all of us. It was a riveting time, particularly for me because I knew Nixon and the pincers were closing around him. One bombshell followed another during the hearings, bringing the scandal closer and closer to the Oval Office. The testimony that Nixon had discussed the cover-up some 35 times with his counsel, the revelation that Nixon taped all his conversations and phone calls in the Oval Office, Nixon's refusal to hand over the presidential recordings to the Senate Watergate Committee. The court ordered, backed up by the Supreme Court, delivery of the tapes, which disclosed a mysterious 18-and-a-half-minute gap that was blamed on Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods. It didn't help Nixon when Spiro Agnew, his vice president, was forced to resign following charges of income tax evasion. Nixon named Gerald Ford as Agnew's replacement. And it certainly did not help Nixon when the House Judiciary Committee started impeachment hearings in May 1974. I was again in Washington for the 3 months of those hearings. At their conclusion in July, I remember being with very close friends, Shirley and Dick Klerman. Dick, who was winding up a brilliant 23-year career as a journalist and chief of correspondence at Time Incorporated, was a close friend of Leonard Garment, John Dean's replacement as Nixon's special counsel. The Klermans, Garment, and I were watching the chair of the committee, Democratic Congressman Peter Rodino, preside over the vote that would send 3 articles of impeachment against Nixon, when Len, who had a very dry sense of humor, said, "Come on, Peter, sink to the occasion." I loved the line and remember it to this day. Soon afterward, along with the rest of the nation, I watched Richard Nixon resign, the first U.S. president ever to do so. Pat Nixon stood ghost-like behind her husband with their 2 daughters, Julie and Tricia. Julie, so close to her father, had begged him not to resign, but he had no option. It was Julie who admitted to me in a later interview that she was the one who had to tell her mother that her father was going to resign. For all the excitement and historical importance of the moment, it was also quite poignant. I thought of all the times that I had been with Nixon, this awkward man who had always been kind to me. I had interviewed him several times. I had covered Trisha's wedding. As I watched him announce his resignation, I felt both anger and pity. Mostly, I thought how devastating this must be to Pat Nixon. She never seemed to have had a close relationship with her husband. The fact that they rarely communicated must have made her all the more lonely, grappling with a situation she could not control, which was going to drag her down too, and this so soon after her triumph in China. In the midst of this intriguing time, I did interviews with people who had nothing to do with politics. Liza Minnelli, for example, who was wowing everyone in a sold-out engagement at the Winter Garden in New York. Henry Fonda, who was winning accolades portraying the famous lawyer Clarence Darrow on Broadway. Maria Callas, the fiery Greek opera diva, who had lost her longtime lover, Aristotle Onassis, to Jackie Kennedy. The Callas interview had a special appeal. For years, people had speculated as to how she felt when Onassis jilted her. Callis admitted in our interview that she and Jackie had never met, and that furthermore, she'd never wanted to meet her. She implied that Onassis had actually proposed to her several times, which I didn't believe, but that she was wary of marriage, having been married once before. She kept talking about how all she wanted was for Onassis to be happy, but it was obvious from her protestations that she herself was heartbroken. Her career, which she had given up for Onassis, was all but over, and so was any hope of rekindling her relationship with him. When eventually Onassis and Jackie split up, Callis came back into his life, but it was reportedly never the same. Most of my interviews, however, dealt with Watergate, with Senator Ted Kennedy, with Martha Mitchell, whose soon-to-be ex-husband, former U.S. Attorney General John Mitchell, would be found guilty of conspiracy, perjury, and obstruction of justice, and serve 19 months in prison, with Jeb Magruder, Nixon's deputy campaign director, who was charged with perjury and conspiracy to obstruct justice, and spent 7 months in prison, with Gail Magruder, Jeb's wife, who said her husband's prison sentence was an anticlimax after all they'd been through. Haldeman, too, went to prison and spent 18 months behind bars, convicted of conspiracy and obstruction of justice. The pivotal figure in all this, of course, remained Richard Nixon, with whom I would continue to have a professional relationship. So I will now digress. After resigning the presidency, Nixon repaired to his house in San Clemente, California, taking with him his press secretary, Ron Ziegler, and his young assistant press secretary, Diane Sawyer. I had no contact with him during this period, though I wrote him often, hoping for an interview. When he finally did do his first interview in 1977, it was not with me, but with the British television journalist David Frost. David, now Sir David, and a good friend of mine, paid Nixon a reported $600,000 for the series of taped interviews over a 24-hour period, which were then boiled down into four 90-minute programs. The most interesting, of course, was the section on Watergate. Because of the presidential pardon Nixon was granted by Gerald Ford, who replaced him as president, Nixon never had to stand trial for his role in Watergate, so no one had as yet heard his side of the story. Nixon had approval over the interview with David, which was taped and edited. There was such curiosity about the former president, and David was such a good interviewer, that the programs were syndicated and seen in 70 countries around the world. To this day, there is still curiosity. In 2007, the play Frost Nixon, based on those interviews, opened on Broadway after playing in London. It was a huge success and was then made into a movie. Nixon came back into my life in 1980, 3 years after the Frost interviews. He approached the networks to promote a book he'd written about foreign policy and the ongoing Cold War with the Soviet Union. It was titled The Real War. But Nixon set conditions for the potential interview. He would do it only if it was live and therefore without any editing. Nixon's first choice was 60 Minutes on CBS. But Don Hewitt, the program's producer, never allowed anything live, and he turned Nixon down. It was Don's loss and my gain. I was at ABC by then, and I sat down with Nixon on May 8th in our New York studio for a live one-hour interview. I had long since developed my own way of preparing for an interview. I wrote down on 3x5 cards as many questions as I could think of, then asked anyone who walked into the office, whether it was somebody delivering the mail, a production assistant, or a hairdresser, if you could ask any question of whomever, what would it be? It was very productive. For this interview with Nixon, I had so many questions that I could have done 6 hours with him. I must have written over 100 questions on my cards, which, as was my custom, I cut down and cut down again and cut down yet again. This was my predicament. If I was too tough on the former president, people would feel sorry for him, and those who still had some admiration or affection for him would turn against me. On the other hand, if I was too soft on him, the criticism would be, why didn't the news department choose somebody tougher to do the interview? It was a delicate balancing act. I finally divided the questions into foreign and domestic policy segments, Watergate, and also a more personal segment. I wanted to give him the opportunity, if he wanted, to talk about such things as what faith meant to him, how his family had helped him get through the resignation and his subsequent health crisis with phlebitis. Even though he had resisted personal questions during my very first interview with him while he was president, I thought he might welcome them now. I saved these questions for near the end of the interview. But the final question was key. Was he sorry he hadn't burned the tapes that led to his resignation? For this last question, I told my director to give me a 30-second cue at the end of the interview. I wanted to give Nixon very limited time to say yes or no rather than skirt the issue. We met in the studio. Nixon was his usual awkward self, trying to be friendly to the crew by making a slightly off-color joke. We put makeup on him because he had a propensity to sweat. Some people felt this had cost him the election during a 1960 television debate with John F. Kennedy. Those who heard the debate on radio thought Nixon had won, while those who saw Nixon sweating on television thought JFK had won. Then we began the interview live. Nixon was superb on foreign policy, but reluctant to talk about Watergate. When I asked him whether he felt responsible for the distrust and cynicism Americans now felt toward their leaders, Nixon replied, "I think under the circumstances that with Watergate now 6 years past, we're at a time when it is time to move forward to the future and not dwell on the past." I pressed, but it was obvious he wasn't going to talk further about Watergate. But he really stonewalled me toward the end of the interview when I got to the personal questions. When I asked him why people who have written books about you, who worked for you, people who are close to you in one way or another, say that you are cold, remote, and that they are unable to reach you, he replied, "Why are you interviewing me then?" I answered by saying I was not talking about whether I found him cold and remote. I was quoting people like Henry Kissinger, to which Nixon curtly responded, "Why don't we get serious?" I went on saying that I was sorry that he found these questions unserious and reminded him that people are interested in you, the man, and your feelings. But he would have none of it. I next wanted to give him that chance to talk about how he got through the dark days. Was it his faith? Were there friends? I was trying to induce some sympathy for him, but he was not about to allow me to go there. When I asked him if, in the early days after Watergate, there were times when you thought you might go under emotionally, Nixon bristled and said, "Not at all." Period. Silence. There was nothing to do then but to go back to the foreign policy questions, the ones I hadn't asked yet. But I couldn't find the right cards. Even today, more than 25 years later, revisiting that moment makes my stomach tighten. I couldn't frantically shuffle and reshuffle the cards on live television, so I had no recourse but to wing it. Fortunately, since I write my own questions and I'd written them 100 times before the interview, I remembered them. We hurtled toward the last segment of the interview, talking about his case for increasing the military budget, the lack of congressional support for it, the upcoming presidential election, which would see Ronald Reagan defeat Jimmy Carter, the downfall of the Shah of Iran, and finally, the 30-second cue. In the few seconds we have left now, and there's almost just time for a yes or no, are you sorry you didn't burn the tapes? Nixon replied that everyone he'd spoken to in Europe had said to him, "Why didn't you burn the tapes?" The answer is, he said, "I probably should have." "If you had it to do all over again, you'd burn them," I pressed in the last seconds. "Yes, I think so," Nixon said, "because they were private conversations, subject to misinterpretation, as we have all seen." There. I'd gotten him to say what would make headlines the next day. "Thank you for being with us," I said, and the interview was over. When we took off our microphones and I stood up to shake his hand, I realized I was ice cold from the strain of having done the last 10 minutes of the interview without any written questions. There we stood, Nixon perspiring through his makeup, and me frigid. It was then when I stood up that I saw that damn pile of questions on my chair. I had put them under my fanny when I thought we were through with the foreign policy segment and had been sitting on them the whole time. Nixon evidently did not object to the interview, and we continued to have a good relationship. I did two other interviews with him, one in 1982, following the death of the Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev, another in 1985, after the publication of his fifth book, No More Vietnams. But then, silence, for a reason not of my making. Soon after Tom Murphy and Capital Cities bought ABC in 1986, the entertainment department bought Woodward and Bernstein's second book about Watergate, The Final Days, to make into a television movie. Nixon did everything he could to prevent the movie from being made. He was protecting his wife, he said. Mrs. Nixon had had two strokes since her husband left office, and he was worried about her.
I myself speak about what I've been through, but you know, for a woman to suffer in silence during the difficult last days in the White House and the days thereafter, which were even worse, is much more difficult, he had told me in our earlier interview about his book.
He was afraid now that the ABC movie, which covered that exact time period, might cause his wife to have another stroke. His plea, however, fell on deaf ears. ABC could have canceled the movie, but they didn't. It was already finished, and they insisted on running it. It got very low ratings, by the way. But Richard Nixon never spoke to me on the air again. When I approached him later for another interview, he turned me down. He liked me personally, he said, but I got my paycheck from ABC. Pat Nixon did not have another stroke after seeing the ABC movie, but her health continued to deteriorate. She died of lung cancer on June 22, 1993. I covered her televised funeral at the Richard Nixon Library and his birthplace in Yorba Linda, California. Nixon was visibly upset. That supposedly cold, remote man cried uncontrollably at the service. I recently learned from a young assistant of Nixon's, Monica Crowley, that after Mrs. Nixon's death, he had a change of heart about me and his boycott of ABC. Nixon had written another book, Beyond Peace, and had decided to do an interview with me. He talked to Monica about rearranging his study for the camera and lights and told her he was looking forward to talking to me. But it was not to be. Nixon suffered a massive stroke on April 18, 1994, which left him partially paralyzed and unable to speak. He died 4 days later at 81. The book was published posthumously.